Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Our guest today is Dr. Heidi Prather. She is an attending physician and professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the Hospital for Special Surgery, Weill Cornell Medicine. She also holds the title of Simonson Family Foundation Scholar. Dr. Prather is the founder and medical director of the HSS Lifestyle Medicine Program, a standardized interprofessional program designed to help people who have musculoskeletal pain improve their whole person health, reduce pain, and enhance function through behavior changes. While at HSS, she has served as the clinical director for value-based programming and medical director for the HSS Osteoarthritis Pilot Program. Nationally, Dr. Prather is a diplomat of the National Board of Medical Examiners and board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation, sports medicine, and is a diplomat of the Board of Lifestyle Medicine. Notably, she was the first female president of both the Physiatric Association of Spine, Sports, and Occupational Rehabilitation and the North American Spine Society. Dr. Prather's research focuses on pre-arthritic hip disorders, the hip-spine connection, gender differences in musculoskeletal disorders and athletic injuries, and the application of lifestyle medicine in musculoskeletal care. Her work has led to over 100 peer-reviewed publications, national and international presentations, and both intra and extramural funding. Today, we're going to talk about lifestyle medicine for musculoskeletal health, a whole person approach to spondyloarthritis. Dr. Prather is going to share lifestyle medicine, including sleep, stress, management, and nutrition, and how it can enhance function, reduce pain, and promote overall well-being for people living with axial spondyloarthritis. Dr. Prather, thank you very much for joining us. I feel honored to have your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about how you landed in the work that you do.
Yeah, so I'm 30 years in. So I've been a clinician for 30 years. And at about, it was 11 years ago, I started pitching the concept of utilizing lifestyle medicine for musculoskeletal care. And the reason for that was I've worked in academics my entire career. I've worked actually in orthopedic departments as a non-operative provider for most of the vast majority of that time. And I was seeing a lot of patients, and then you'd see them again, and then you'd see them again. And I had a lady in my practice for about 10 years. And she had autoimmune disease, was not spondyloarthritis, but it was in the genre of rheumatological autoimmune diseases, and a blood clotting disorder, and a neck and a shoulder and a this and a that. And she's sitting there in front of me one day in a neck brace, in a wheelchair. She's come back from Florida thanking me for helping her. And I was like, I am not helping you. So it was like a revolving door, and that patient had been with me for 10 years, and I saw her often, and she was very active in her own healthcare. And she was like, we had it down to when she could take an ibuprofen because of her blood disorder, and when she could take a narcotic to try to manage this global pain that she had. And I had been introduced to lifestyle medicine, but particularly the nutritional piece is that thing that physiatry I didn't know as much about. I know about sleep. I know about physical activity. I know about managing stress. I know those things. Those are core in our training. But the nutrition and risky substance and social connections, which are the other three pillars of lifestyle medicine, are not things that were mainstay. So dietitian that I love and still work with today brought me almond butter one day that was all goopy and a mess. And she told me how to put my refrigerator. I'm like, why is she giving me this weird gift? And we got into the nutritional piece of it. And I had been afraid, I adopted it myself, but I had been afraid to like go into that with patients about pain. There wasn't a lot of literature on it. And I asked this patient, and hey, would you try this? And come back in 3 weeks and tell me it's hooey or whatever. And she came back and she says, I'm not stopping this. This is helping me.
Wow.
And that, and she, that, and there's a story video. You can look at the Washington University School of Medicine, lifestyle medicine program. It's called the Living Well Center. And that story is still on that. It's up there for public knowledge. So I have full permission to talk about it. Probably send her this podcast too.
I would
so she still knows she's helping people, but she had enough faith in me to go try this craziness that, you know, that, why is she talking about nutrition? And it made me really flip into, it's okay. It is my lane to talk about this. I've got to get more training. I've got to get more comfortable with it. I was practicing it myself for my own personal reasons and family history, but I saw it as the platform for a better way to provide systematic care for patients with musculoskeletal conditions. And obviously spinal arthropathy is in huge need of that, right?
Huge.
Yeah. And so then I got to a nutritional conference called the Plantrician Project, and that's all about the evidence around eating and global health, and went fully in myself personally. And then I got to the American College of Lifestyle Medicine first meeting and went, oh, here's the format I've been trying to pitch for this period of time. And that really helped me solidify systematically how to approach a CEO and say, can we do this? And I don't go away very easily. It was three times I pitched that over a course of a year and a half. Finally got a pilot together 3 years later, raised money, built a building. The Living Well Center opened, and that was on Friday, and Monday was the pandemic. So went virtual by June of that year. And I tomorrow get on a plane and go celebrate their fifth anniversary. So the model is working. And I'm very passionate about lifestyle medicine because I see it as a format to help change not just people's health globally, which is super important, but systematically this thing really works. And we've really got to shift how we deliver care because we're not helping people be healthy.
No.
We're throwing things at symptoms. And you know, I grew up in pain and function. That's the thing our field looks at, is how do you improve impairment and disability, reduce pain, improve quality of life. That's why people go into the field I'm in. And though I was doing that, I felt like I was really just managing a lot of symptoms, which was helpful to people. But lifestyle medicine is effective in people whose disease is rooted in chronic systemic inflammation. And that's evidence-based.
Yeah.
And it's a no-brainer when I'm watching this. I'm like, well, why aren't we doing this in musculoskeletal medicine? Why is this only diabetes in a cardiovascular disease application? And that's what I turned the corner.
Yeah. And you said the word, which always gets me excited, which is root, right?
Root cause. Not just symptom. Yeah. And we need symptom management. But
yeah,
you know, when you go after root cause, symptoms start to improve.
Yeah.
When
you described your patient, like many, I'm sure of us who've been down this road, I remember one of the days for me where I was like, I am done with the traditional approach.
Right.
Was being on, I don't know, it was like 9 medications, and there was one that was giving me a problem, and somebody said, well, we'll just give you this to offset that. And I was like, I can't, you can't treat the, why you were treating the treatment. Mm-hmm. And so that's amazing. What a story. And do you think, I mean, this is a bit of a sidebar, but do you think the pandemic, you were probably a lifeline for a lot of people mm-hmm. when it went virtual? Some of these things, I wonder if there was more success because of the pandemic in the short, like in.
A great point. So yes, I was in Missouri. I worked at Washington University School of Medicine for 22 years, and I'm so grateful for that foundation and that experience. And the lifeline, yes, a lot of it was the social lifeline, right? I'm talking to people in nursing homes that are isolated and stress, and it was just such a hard time. But yes, it pushed the virtual piece. And so the Living Well Center at Washington University School of Medicine is still hybrid. They have a beautiful space, and they have a cooking kitchen, and it's beautiful. And they have hybrid. They have some things virtually that are group programming, and then they have a lot of times people come in for specific interventions and or even just counseling. I was supported by the CEO of Hospital for Special Surgery for a couple years about this program, and pandemic happens. I'm married to a physician, had moved to another city because our plan was to, I would slow down and he would do this and I would just do lifestyle medicine, and our life was all figured out, and what fools we were. So, and so life really changed, right? Yeah. And so I actually retired and didn't know if I'd work again. They were pursuing me, but it was a pandemic and it was New York, which was very serious as far as the day-to-day changes. It was serious everywhere, but obviously the heart of it was the New York Presbyterian, and the Hospital for Special Surgery is the orthopedic hospital for New York Presbyterian. So so I was hired part-time and to bring in this program, and it's entirely virtual. And I don't think that would have happened right away if, you know, the pandemic had not forced it. And for New Yorkers, and we cover a 4-state area, so we're in New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey, and Florida. It's life-saving because patients can't get to us. I've got people that can't leave their apartment without considerable help because of their chronic disease and their musculoskeletal condition that's not allowing them to weight bear and walk well and all those things. And so it's been a learning curve for me to how do you create community, because community is such an important piece of the lifestyle medicine program. How do you do that on Zoom, you know? And we have some hybrid programming. I do a hybrid program one Saturday a month, and that is attended well. We'd like for it to be better attended, but people really have bought into doing this collaboratively online, and it makes the access and the number of things they can attend greater. So yeah, I'm with you that it kind of forced the issue. But I don't think we would have done it as quickly as we did if that hadn't happened. So, no. You know, I think it's been actually a good thing.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I can go on for hours, but let's not get too distracted. okay, so can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned some of the pillars, I think, of lifestyle medicine, but can you tell us a little bit about the program and how it supports?
Sure. Yeah. So there are 6 pillars of health. They're all evidence-based to reduce chronic systemic inflammation, which is root cause for chronic lifestyle-related diseases. So that can be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, but it's also IBS, it's also autoimmune diseases. The whole just bucket of autoimmune fits there. Some cancers, especially breast, colon, colorectal cancer, and prostate have some roots, you know, related to lifestyle. So any of those things, allergies, multiple sclerosis, any of them fit into this may be able to attend to this model. And the idea is to enable people to make behavior changes in those six pillars that improves their lifestyle, which improves their chronic systemic inflammation, which then helps them manage disease, such as treatment, improve and even reverse, in some cases, some of those chronic lifestyle-related diseases. 60% of osteoarthritis in this country is metabolic in nature.
Can we double click on that really quick?
Yeah, but when's the last time the person giving you a shot in your knee talked to you about what you ate last night and how well are you sleeping? Right? And it should be a main, if that's part of the cause, shouldn't we be educating people about that? And so I see it as an important role as a musculoskeletal provider to make sure people have an understanding that this exists, that it's available. Even if you don't become a lifestyle medicine provider yourself, you're aware of it so that you can have that conversation, have a place for those patients to get referred, because that's what really will help us globally improve not just a person's individual global health, but just health of this population of patients in general.
That is, that's a shocking stat, but
it's a lot.
I have a lot going on in my head right now about, there's so many questions. I'm like, how do you take this and create it into, it becomes the template for how we show up every day in our jobs and our,
right?
How does this, right? So I think that the, what are the six pillars?
So the six pillars are nutrition, and it's mostly focusing on eating more plants. You don't have to be plant only, but more plants on your plate is your goal. And there's lots of data that shows the more you go towards eating the plant, obviously the less chronic disease and all-cause mortality actually goes down. So, so that's when there's many diets that fit under that. But once you get going, you really do understand this is like how I choose to live my life and not a restrictive diet. Right. And unfortunately in our country, diets have been labeled as things you can only do this. And that's not at all. Ours is more about, these are the things that have the most nutrition in them. This is, and I know this population that's listening to this knows this well, but like, this is how you balance your gut microbiome, because that is the crux of getting inflammation out of your body. And to balance the gut biome, it needs to be, you know, fiber, and the only thing that contains fiber is plants.
Right.
Right. And reduction of fat. So nutrition, that's a biggie. And that's honestly always the hardest learning curve, because you got podcasts and you got Instagram and you got everybody selling you something and telling you to live, you know, what's the truth with it's evidence-based and what's not. So that's always a big one. Physical activity. And it's really physical activity. You don't have to be pumping iron at a gym every day. It's really about how much are you moving, and is how do you keep movement a big part of your life? Sleep health. I think it's one of the determinants of health that probably gets the least amount of attention for the medical community. So we have individual programs, but we also actually have a group program that runs every other week for four sessions. So it's over 8 weeks, and you get homework in between to really give people ideas, you know, why sleep's important, the quality of your sleep versus hours of sleep, the cycle of sleep versus circadian rhythm, what you eat, when you eat, how much salt you took in, your stress level, how all of that affects your sleep health. And then you get goals and kind of homework assignments in between those. And the idea is at the end of it, we didn't just give you here's a handout, go sleep better, right? Yeah. Here's a goal, come back, what worked, what didn't work, and you problem solve. And with our population, especially, everybody has pain. Mm-hmm. And so about 72% of our population that we have published on have a sleep problem, because they either can't fall asleep, they sleep less than 6 hours, or they're awakening with pain. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, I know a lot. I mean, most everybody I know, I people often look at me, and because I admittedly am like, I stopped sleeping 12 years ago, and you might have to like lock me up to not let me take something for sleep at night, because I've never been able to crack it. It's so, and people are like, are you sure you want to do that? And it's, listen, it's me, it's not everyone, and that's not advice. But to me, there's nothing more important than the sleep, because that is directs right. how you feel.
Right. Well, it's when your DNA gets repaired.
Yeah.
It's when your fear during the day gets muted, right? When you sleep less, your edginess and things that you fear or anxious about is higher. So if you're prone to like a stressful job or a stressful relationship or just stress in life, right? And you don't sleep, that's amplified the next day. When that's amplified, your pain's amplified. It's just this whole circuitous thing. So sleep's a pillar, and then managing stress. So really mental health. Risky substances. So knowing how much alcohol is really thought to be sort of kind of the limit on what that is, and the type and the amount, and monitoring that, and obviously smoking. And then social connections. So that's something in physical medicine and rehabilitation in my training, I learned primarily on the impairment disability side, based on social supports for people with impairment and disabilities, but it's not something that was expanded on with just general health. And so we have sessions and educational interactions with that. And we, you know, take a baseline, you know, you live in a house, great. Who do you live with? Are they supportive of you making change? And then if they're not, how do we work around that, and goals even around, you know, social connections, because they are linked to purpose, happiness, all those things in life. I think I got all six pillars there.
You did. But, I've been writing them down.
Good. I'm glad you're writing. So those are the six pillars. And the thing about them is there's evidence with each individual pillar, when that is improved, the systemic inflammation goes down, health is better. One of my research goals in the next 2 years is how to show, like, we're seeing patients, we have a large volume of patients I'm seeing, obviously, right before surgery, and they're trying to get as healthy as possible prior to surgery, which is great. But they're making really big changes in a shorter amount of time than what other literature has showed. And I think it's because they are so geared towards this goal of having their knee replaced or their hip replaced, because it's so dysfunctional to their life, right? So you offer them this program to help improve behavioral change, and they like get on it. It's so impressive how fast it happens. But it's not that they all lost 50 pounds, right? Because that's a big problem, especially in osteoarthritis. They might have lost 12 pounds or 20 or whatever in this. The average, they're with us about 4 months or so. So that's about the max you'd want somebody to lose in that amount of time anyway. But they also improved their sleep by 30 minutes a day. And they also started eating more whole food. And they became more mobile, because they worked with our exercise kinesiologist, who's got them on a couch moving, even though they can't weight bear. Yeah. And I think it's the multi-directional impact of the six pillars is where the real value is. So it doesn't have to be this unsurmountable, oh my God, I've got to lose that much weight in order to, no. Weight's important, but we know, even our literature shows, weight loss alone does not make you healthier, right? It's probably the interaction of all of the pillars that really get people to these big changes and improvements in their health. So it's going to be a major statistical nightmare to figure out how to put that in a paper. But as a clinician, I think it's really important for people to understand that if I made a little goal here and a little goal here and a little goal here, and I made movement on both of them, I globally got a lot better.
Yeah. And I think this kind of talk, and like the research piece on a lot of this is there's missing work that needs to be done. For what it's worth, I love promoting that we need more research in spondyloarthritis around these things.
Of course.
And it's so critical. And there's a looming question in my head always has been for 30 years, why don't our docs talk about this? Is it risk related? Is it training out of a book and it's crazy because we need it so desperately. And this idea too around research is, and I'm simplifying it dramatically, I realize, But to me, the research piece is what's critical, because it's where, when you look at the product noise on Instagram and all the places that are telling you you need to eat more protein or do this or do that, most of those have glommed onto one teeny tiny piece of research, and they're building a multi-million dollar business on it. We have to get the word out that there is research that shows when you attack it from all fronts and it becomes a lifestyle, mm-hmm. hence the branding, it's so important, right?
Right.
Yeah.
No, I couldn't agree more. We're pumping out the research, and I'm doing as fast as I can, and I'm not very fast, but I'm working at it. So between my group here at HSS and then the group at Washington University School of Medicine, we try to combine things when we can. So I talked to you about this sleep program that we have. We're trialing the same exact intervention and taking measures before and after, and then satisfaction scores from patients that go through it. Because the patient population in Missouri is obviously very different than the patient population in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut by a long, they're very different. So what if it works in both populations? If we put our data together, that's very believable, right? And so that's one of our missions. We've got that project ongoing right now. The Living Well Center at Washington University School of Medicine, their lead for research director is a physician named Abby Chang. I've mentored Abby since she was a first year med student, and her mission in life is to be a true clinician scientist. And she has gotten major grants in several millions of dollars that we hope will stick around for right now, based on what happening in our government. But so they're applying long COVID cases using this model, and she's worked on a behavioral health app that helps patients with self-management that's integrated into their electronic medical record.
That is
now that you say that, so her initial funding, we were on the grant together, and it's called it's internal funding from the university, and it was a great idea grant. Wow. And she got the great idea grant, and it became an NIH funded grant. So they're going to pump out research on that, and already have started that at the Living Well Center. At HSS, I have this opportunity because the population is so large. This is, 1% of all total joint surgeries are done at this hospital. I have this huge ability to just get large patient level data. And we're just hoping that when we put our stuff together, when we're publishing on our unique things but we're the only two centers right now in the country that have this model. I hope, because we're having success, and like you said, the research is so important, when they see the stats on what happens when people are treated with this mechanism, one, we'll have better ways of payment for it, but number two, others will adopt it.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I could spend a week with you. So in terms of, let me just pause for a second. The app you were talking about, mm-hmm. because I think this is, it's Abby Chang is her name.
Abby Chang, ABBY Chang, CHENG, MD. And she's a wonderful clinician, but she's a wonderful researcher. And so it's the WISA app, WISA. If you look on your app, it has a little icon of a penguin. And there's a free form of that. And there's one that you pay into. And there's several apps like this out there. The beauty of that, the reason she went in that direction, is that particular company actually adapted the app for people with pain.
That's fantastic.
Right? Because we all know stress, there's stress management, and then there's pain plus stress. Those are different animals that you got to approach in a different way. Mm-hmm. Correct? And especially when you have persistent pain, right? Yeah. Which is a daily thing you live with. That's a very different beast than I'm stressed out because of a relationship, my boss that doesn't like me or I don't like them or whatever. Those are episodic, right? But when you have a persistent pain problem, stress is a different beast. And so you got to address people in that way. So that they're doing amazing things with that. And then my goal is to put out research and our outcomes on common man coming in with common problems and then identifying them based on subgroups. Like this is a group that had this prior to surgery. This is a group that came to us that didn't do well after surgery. This is a group that's trying to avoid surgery, right? So non-operative. So people trying to manage their chronic musculoskeletal condition. And again, if you fit in that wide bucket and you're interested, you're a candidate. It's not this exclusive thing. It should be very inclusive. I've got early data. I got accepted at a poster next week, so I or it's this week, so I can talk about it. But our Medicare patients do great.
I'm
You know,
sure.
people would think, oh, they're older, they got more problems. I'm like, no, they actually kick it in this program.
I mean, listen, I got
So
my butt kicked by a couple of 84-year-old guys 2 weeks ago in racquetball, and I went home with cannabis oil and a steroid for my tendonitis. But no, it's brilliant, and it's, I think you touched on it earlier. There was a moment where you're talking about the program that you guys are doing and how that unfolds into. You can have data all day long, and until it unfolds into education and you move into on a personal level, right? The data can say everything all day long, but we all have to come to our own understanding. And I think you touched on it when people get prepped for surgery or there's a dire need, or many people like living with spondyloarthritis. We don't always, I would probably was one of them, don't take care of our health until you lose it. And getting, I think moving our medical system to get ahead of that would be wonderful. But having something that helps to guide the docs when they are talking to us, so
So I
powerful.
think, I think I got us off track there because you did ask.
No.
I want to go back to that. So yes, like why isn't my provider talking to me about it? Well, so this is Heidi-isms, right? This completely just my opinion, so please take it that way. One, we aren't trained in this in med school. I was never taught that blood pressure was something that was reversible. I was never taught that diabetes was reversible. Once you have it, you have it, and because your dad has it, you're going to get it, right? So there is genetic factors to things, right? And a lot of these, 60% of it's genetic, but there's a 30, 35% that you can control in the expression of that gene, we hope, through lifestyle. And that's been demonstrated scientifically, whether it's a cancer level, cardiovascular level, and endocrine level for sure. So know that. Like I got the bad gene pool, don't throw in the towel, and you can improve those things even if you have gone down a path, maybe lifestyle well, that's not good. Shifting backwards, especially in the musculoskeletal world and like preclinical trials, you can see some of the reversal of that inflammatory factors and the synovium of a joint and that kind of thing.
Which is big
So
for
that's
people with us.
yes, yeah. Number so number one, it's not mainstream in med school and medical training. And that is one of the missions of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine is to get this into medical schools. They've spent a lot of time and effort in doing that. That organization is very different than other medical associations where it's about give away as much as you can because you're trying to get this message, you're trying to get this shift in medicine to
Create a
happen.
movement.
Yes. And they're succeeding. Nothing happens overnight, but they are succeeding. Like just in the time I've been a member, just the growth that I've seen in that. So that's number one. Number two, reimbursement. Part of my frustration, I tell this story often, is like I was a provider. I don't know. I'm in year 16 or 17. I'm the director of the program, I've become a vice chair of the department, blah, 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 right? Supposedly I'm very successful. I have a 6-month waiting list. It is miserable. My medical assistant, God bless her, would knock on the door and say, "Get out. You've been in there too long." If I'd hear the knock on the door, it meant like I'm way too backed up. Get out, right? And I would sit there and go, oh, geez, this is bad. And that year, I remember this year that I really flipped. I'd seen many thousands of patients individually, and I'm sitting with the business person, and they said, you need to see more. How can you increase next year? And I'm like, I shouldn't increase next year, is what's going on in my head. I'm a bad doctor. I felt like a bad doctor. And that's when I really, again, almond butter happened. My patient started nutritional changes, and suddenly she was, not taking narcotics eventually. And that happened. And it's like, this is just, there's no alignment. There's no incentive for me to help people get healthier.
Right.
I am paid based on what I give you, the medicine I give you, the procedure I do, and there's no time for education. And so you either have to have really long appointments and then you're not reimbursed, or you create a program. And so that was part of the NIDUS for that, was creating a program. So number two is we are not incentivized on our payment system to help people get healthier. Okay, so that's number two. And number three, you're right, is just the want to do it, right? If this is, I think people that are really interested in this area, we need many of them, because it does take time to do this, but it can be scalable. So like I've talked to you about, like we have all these different providers in our program. So we have a dietitian, we have exercise kinesiology, which is a total wonderful, over the top, great thing, because a lot of people don't have access to them. Physical therapy, we have counseling, we have a health coach, smoking cessation, and we have culinary medicine. So we've got all of the pieces, and people can choose who they want on their team after we set goals. So the patient sets the goals. Oftentimes it's usually 3 to 4 goals they have. Like, I want to improve my nutrition, I want to lose weight, I want to reduce my pain, I want to sleep better. Okay, those are their goals. Who do you want on your team? We've gone through, your pillars, and they pick their team members, and then we implement it. And they can meet with that dietitian one-on-one, but we've created group programming so it's scalable, so they can get more information, community, right? Everybody on the call is trying to do the same exact thing. What do you mean I shouldn't eat? What do you mean I shouldn't have 6 things of Greek yogurt every day? I thought Greek yogurt was good for me. Well, it's pretty inflammatory because it's a dairy product and it has no fiber, and it can be high in fat if you don't eat the right one. So you're doing that with people repetitively, and now it becomes scalable. And if I can be on a call and have 15 people on, and I'm charging a short return visit for each of them, I economically am doing okay, right? So my business people are okay with me doing this,
Right, the
right?
finance guys are
The
okay.
right. I'm not losing money because I sat in the room too long talking to somebody in their mind, right?
Right.
But you're also bringing community to it, and you're bringing standardization to it, right? And that's a big problem with education, is like you need to measure where the person is, where they are. You need to put and implement a plan with them, and that needs to be standardized, right? I can't give Jody one thing and Sam another and say they both changed over the same thing. I gotta implement standardization. So we have curriculum that we've developed and we keep developing, and it's the most fun thing I do, because it's like, what do we need? What do patients need now? Like, we have book club now. You don't have to buy the book, you don't have to check the book out, and you actually don't have to read the book, but you can come to book club, right? And we'll
You get to
review something.
rewind too.
Yeah, exactly. So the last book we did, they chose, was Atomic Habits.
Ooh, amazing.
Yeah, so how do you make small changes? How you change your system? He talks a lot about changing your system, not just your habit, and how to, and what works and what doesn't work for you, and people love it. So it becomes this very creative space, but you're able to distribute that information to a lot of people, and then they have community in it, because Sally over there asked a question that I wouldn't have thought to ask, but it's applicable to me. And now the value of this just went up for me. So it's a
Right.
win-win. The difference with lifestyle medicine is, from an educational standpoint, is not just giving you education. The idea is we measure where the patient is at the time. Where are you now with your metabolic status, your sleep status, your stress status? We do an intervention that's standardized so we can give it to multiple people. And then we measure again. What's your anxiety scores now? What's your metabolic load now? Whatever that is, the intervention is, we tailored that measurement to that. And that's where we can start to show that this is scale, it is scalable. We're proving that. and we can show measurable change. It wasn't just that nice thing you did over there, Heidi. Like that improved, that moved the needle. Average patient in our program, their pain score down goes down by 3. So if your average pain is a 7, your new average is a 4.
And that is life changing.
Correct, right? And recently, we have a lead operations gentleman here, not clinical at all. He's been our hero. He's really helped us like expand this thing. And we've had that data out for over a year. And he goes, "You did that without drugs. You did that without injection and procedures." I went, "Yes, you get it." And he's deep in it with me. And it's like, sometimes you kind of startle and go, "God, that really happened." I mean, yeah, that happened because somebody slept better. That happened because their stress is less. Their community is better. You know, they feel like they have control because it's them making those changes. So yeah, the bottom line is this is very scalable. We need to have sustainable economic models for it because we're kind of bouncing against what we're normally paid for in our healthcare system. But I think the more evidence we can drive out there, the closer we'll be to that. And we just got to get more access for more people, and particularly people with musculoskeletal problems that are painful, that inhibit function and quality of life.
Wow. And you know what's interesting before I land the plane here? The 6 areas or pillars that you talk about, I did my own analysis as we were preparing for our 100th episode. Mm-hmm. And those are really the 6 emerging, or those are the 6 consistent themes across 100 of our episodes about our disease, of how we live a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. And it's so incredible, the power of taking the first action. And I know you're a crazy busy person. I would love to have you back again for a second episode in a longer time.
I would love it. I would love it. I could do this all night. If
you I could too. Maybe I'll call you next week. Maybe I'll call you next time I'm in New York. The last question I have for you, because this has been such a pleasure, is if you had one wish for everyone where they could start just to change the first behavior, what would it be?
The one they see that's easiest to change.
Low-hanging fruit.
Yep. And the thing you say, "Oh, I wouldn't make that a goal because it's too easy." That's the one you start with.
Amazing. I love it.
So yeah, I'm going to go to bed at 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock. That's it. Start there.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to challenge our listenership for all of that. Dr. Prather, you've been so delightful. I love the work you're doing and grateful that you got in front of the CEO 3 times, because I think a lot of times most of us would have given up by then. So keep up the good work. And yeah, we would love to check in with you as you are on your journey.
All right. I appreciate you having me.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.